I may have all the bits together. So apologies in advance. I'm going to have to leave here at about 12:20. A lot of times we're wrapping up around the mid then anyway, but if not, I still have to go. Okay, so last time we were talking about the characteristics of the radio link, and we said that signals were transmitted over a radio link via antennas, and again, the main characteristic that we care about for antennas is either they're omnidirectional, so radiate equally in all directions, or they can be directional, so they can be pointed in a specific direction and have the power concentrated in a specific direction. Okay. We then had a look at what happens to the radio signal as it's traveled through space, and we divided the effects into large scale and small scale fading. And the idea of large scale fading is that the signal drops as some exponential with distance. Okay. Free space says that that exponential is a power of 2. Having an actual terrain means that that power might be something greater than 2. Okay. And so there's a lot of complicated modeling that can go into trying to decide what exactly that exponential should be. Again, as we go forward, we're just going to assume that it is an exponential and sort of pick whatever value we want at the time. We saw that the picture was considerably complicated with what were called small-scale effects, and these are caused by the motion of the sender, the receiver, and or the environment, and also multipath effects, so signals bouncing off from various directions. And we saw that these changes could occur in either a slow or a fast fashion. So either over a time frame greater than a bit duration, or could even be changing during the transmission of a single bit. They also were either flat or frequency selective, meaning that relative to the bandwidth of the signal, they sort of diminished everything equally, or, you know, again, certain frequencies within that bandwidth were had greater diminution. Okay, so what we're going to look at today are spread spectrum techniques, some two in particular, and we're going to, again, consider how they can, in some way, deal with these sort of small-scale effects. Before we do that, I left you with a question, okay, and that's saying that channel conditions are changing, possibly predictably, possibly unpredictably. And so what can we do to deal with this issue? Okay. So, I'm making one suggestion. Anybody have any suggestions?
Send multiple durations of the signal.
Sorry?
Actually, that's a
good suggestion, and we will actually be dealing with that today a bit, but redundancy. So you can try and recreate your signal from multiple copies. Okay, and actually isn't one I have down, so good work. So the first one I thought of, well, just increase the power you're transmitting at. Okay. But there are practical limits to how much you can do that. You're not going to be the only transmitter in the world, so you can't just send it. If you start sending it sort of infinite power, you're just going to annoy everybody. Okay. And any wireless system that we look at is going to in some way cap the power, the maximum power at which a signal can be transmitted. So, assuming that you have some maximum power, even if you forget about small scale effects, you're still decreasing with large scale effects. Okay. So, what it means essentially is that your link can have varying characteristics. So if you think of a wired link, well, you actually do have the same attenuation, but you know the length of the wire. So, you can account for the attenuation within your transmission system. Here, the length of the wire depends on, where you're standing. Are you walking? Are you moving? Okay. So, typically, what we do is we try to adjust our modulation encoding schemes based on our channel quality. And the first cut at this is that, again, when we think we consider the large scale effects, and obviously as you go away from your base station, your signal strength is decreasing. Okay. So there are two things you can do. You can transmit less data. You slow down your data rate the farther out you get, because the slower the data rate, the better chance your receiver has of correctly decoding your signal. Okay. And I guess I do sort of have the redundancy issue in here. The second thing you can do is to modify your channel coding scheme. Again, the worse your channels, the farther away you are, you strengthen the coding scheme, you send more redundancy. Okay. So in this case, we're more close, we have a good channel, we have a 2-3 encoding scheme, so 2 bits of data and 1 bit of code, the 1 bit of code, and as we go out, we increase that to 1-2, so 1 bit of data, 1 bit of code. Okay. So almost every reasonably sophisticated wireless system is going to use some permutation on this. So your cellular, your LTEs use this, your wireless like 802.11 will use these sorts of ideas. I don't know whether we'll get to it, but 802.11n, one of the more modern 802.11 schemes, has 78 different combinations of modulation encoding schemes specified. They may or may not all be implemented, but in theory they could be. Okay, so the other obvious effect is that depending on what modulation encoding scheme you're using, the actual amount of data that you transmit is changing. Okay, so again, that's just to again emphasize a point that wireless links again are a bit different than wired links. And you do need to account for the fact that there is variability. Just depending on the physical arrangements. Okay, so today we're going to have a look at spread spectrum techniques, and basically ways of transmitting our data that will both possibly improve the possibility of reception and also be able to squeeze more bandwidth out of our spectrum. Okay, so we already said one of the issues with wireless systems is that it's very difficult to add bandwidth. You can't add more air. You can allocate more spectrum, but there is only a fixed amount of spectrum. So, again, what we want to do is try and squeeze as much data through that spectrum as possible. Okay, and so what we'll see is that the techniques go hand in hand a bit. Spread spectrum improves the data characteristics and hence the spectral efficiency. And then when using conjunction with MIMO, we can actually, in some ways, define new channels within our fixed spectrum. Okay. And so hence increase, again, the amount of data we can have in the spectrum. So the spread spectrum, your basic spread spectrum, either a frequency hopping or a direct sequence, is contained in Stallings. It didn't look, but there's probably a radio electronics tutorial for that as well. OFDM and MIMO, there's some nice radio electronics tutorials, so they give you the sort of basic ideas of how this works. Okay. So both techniques are still present in current networks. Again, most higher performance networks have moved to the OFDM solution. Okay. So some versions of 802.11b use this spread spectrum, direct sequence spread spectrum. 3G cellular systems used spread spectrum. Bluetooth and Zigbee, which are short distance solutions. Everybody knows what Bluetooth is. You hook up your phone to your hands-free set or to your speakers or whatever. Okay, so they use spread spectrum. Okay. Again, what's missing from that list is the more modern local area network standards, 4G systems, etc. They've all moved to an OFDM solution. Okay. So, why do we want to use spread spectrum? What is spread spectrum? It's something that's spreading the bandwidth of the system. Why is that a good idea? Well, because you're not going to have small-scale effects totally taking out your signal. Potentially it's taking out portions of your signal still, but not the whole thing. So hopefully if you have enough left, you can recover your signal. So, again, the original intent was to gain some immunity to noise and multipath fading. And you do that by spreading the bandwidth of the signal. Of course, the question you turn around and ask, well, if your signal's taking up more bandwidth, can't you have less users? Aren't you limiting the users in your system? Well, it turns out that if you're clever about it, you can actually still share the same bandwidth between multiple users. And so, you know, again, those are probably the two big themes of the day, is improving the situation for a single user versus, again, sharing out among multiple users. Okay. And so the basic idea is you start with, you have your bit stream, and you combine this with what's called a spreading mode. Okay. And again, what that code is going to do is then spread the signal over from, if they get a narrow bandwidth signal, and spread it over the breathing bandwidth. You send it, and then at the other end, you reverse, you apply the spreading code again, same spreading code again, and recover the initial signal. Okay, now there's going to be two ways in which we do this. The first that we're going to consider is what's called frequency hopping, spread spectrum, and here we change the carrier frequency of the signal periodically. So originally you would have envisaged you're assigned a carrier frequency, and that's what you transmit on. Now you're going to change that as time goes on. Okay. The spreading is going to be achieved by more the rate of change of the signal than anything else. So, we subdivide any channel into a number of subchannels, and so you're going to do some multiple of 2 to the k. Why? Because then you can indicate which subchannel it is as a k bit. Okay. The spacing then between the subchannels has to be governed by the bandwidth of the input signal, so you have a narrow band signal and you still can't have them interfering with each other. Okay. The transmitter is going to operate on a given subchannel for a fixed period of time, and the sequence of subchannels is going to be governed by the spreading code. Okay. So we have signal coming in, and so it's going to be a sinusoid with a fixed frequency, and then we're going to move that frequency by applying another sinusoid at a different frequency. Okay. And so the final frequency will be the sum of the two. Okay. Again, having a look at that, we're going to again start with a signal, which is again a sinusoid with a carrier frequency
frequency of F0, and then modulated by delta F. We have a bit duration of T. Again, we're going to apply to it a sinusoid at some other frequency. That's going to, and this will change over time, but at any given time, we'll have a frequency at I. Applying that, what we're doing is we're multiplying two cosines together, and so we get, again, a shifted carrier frequency of F0 plus Fi, and then side bands at F0 minus Fi. We have to filter the side band out. Okay. So we filter, leaving only the shift through the shift. Naturally, at the other end, we just do that again. We apply our sinusoid Fi again, frequency Fi again. And again, you'll get the two bands, the plus and the minus. This time, of course, we want to recover our original signal, so we filter away the other half. Okay. And so in that way you recover your original signal. So as long as you apply the same code, the same sinusoid at sender and receiver, you're going to get your original signal back in somewhat attenuated. Now, there's no reason you have to use binary frequency shift keying. You know, you can, you know, the same concept obviously applies to any level you want to put on your original modulation scheme. So you can have, you know, any number of changes in the original modulation scheme, and, you know, given as before, as we discussed before, so L is the number of bits then that we're trying to encode, and therefore we need 2 to the L different changes. Okay, so the frequency is going to change. Well, the hopping is going to occur every TC. Or so, no, there's a frequency change every TC seconds. And so for data A up, data rate R, that can be the duration 1 over R. And so the duration of the signaling element then is L times T. If our shipping code is changing less often than our signaling element, then this is what's referred to as slow frequency hop spread spectrum, and if it changes more often than our signaling element, it's referred to as fast frequency hop spread spectrum. Okay. And so again, you can see that for the benefit of recovering a single signaling element, you really do want to apply a faster chipping code to allow us to, again, possibly counteract effects of frequency selective fading. Okay, so to look at a couple of examples. Here we have slow frequency hop spread spectrum, and so our chipping code, we have four different hops for our frequency, and then within that film, representing two-bit element, two bits per signaling element, so there's four hops related to the different hop permutations of the signaling element. We have two signaling elements into each hop. So, first, we're down at our base frequency, so to speak, and so our first signaling element is represented as 0,0, representing the lowest frequency carrier, and then you go up to 1,1, so within the same hop band, you're changing your signaling elements. You then change, then you then hop. So you hop from 0,0, then at bottom to 1,0, near the top, 1 down to the top, and then again within that you modulate depending on your signaling elements. Then we go up to the top with 1,1 with our chipping code of 1,1 and modulate for the two different signaling elements. Okay. Down to 0,1, modulate for our two different signaling elements, then we then up to 1,1, modulate for the two different signaling elements. Yes?
What is going to be the advantage of this here? Why can't we just send this is 1,1 one frequency the whole time? This seems like
if you send it along at one frequency, you run the risk that that's the frequency that's been killed, essentially. So it is work, yeah. But again, you're trying to guard against the frequency selective fading, and so again, it doesn't slow frequency hopping doesn't get too exciting when you're doing it fast. You're doing hops while you're still sending the same signal, so if part of it gets killed, you can still reconstruct, hopefully, from the rest of it. Okay, so again, we now have fast frequency hop spread spectrum. And here, over the duration of a single signaling element, which again, each signaling element here in this example is 2 bits, we're hopping. So we're changing the frequency at which we transmit. We carry a frequency at which we transmit that signaling element. Okay. So, we have our first signaling element, 0,0, and we start, our chipping code starts down in the bottom range, and so we're down in the bottom corner. Halfway through sending the signal, our chipping code
changes, and we now are over into a different carrier for the same signal. We then go to our second symbol, which is the bits 1-1, and again we pop, we change the carrier frequency over which that symbol is transmitted.
And we continue on in that way. Our next symbol is 1-0, and again, we end up with transmitting it over two different carrier frequencies. Okay. So, again, what we want is that we have essentially a lot of different options for hopping. And this means that your signal is now not concentrated in a very small portion. You know, originally, the signal would be concentrated in the range of D, but is now spread out over our full range. Okay. So, again, hopefully that will give us some resistance to frequency-specific fading, frequency-selective fading, and if you're in the military, it also gives you resistance to jamming, so resistance to deliberate interference. Okay. And so, again, the way to think of this is that originally our power is concentrated in our bandwidth WD. And we're going to assume that our jammer is a fixed power. So initially it would have to be concentrated that power in the narrowband signal. Okay. So again, you're concentrating your power in the narrowband signal. If we use frequency hopping, well, then it's going to have to spread that power out over now the whole range. Okay. And so, again, if we assume that there's only so much power that the jammer can operate at, then we've decreased the effectiveness by the ratio of WS over WD. So the more hops you have, more energy that is going to be spread for the jammer. The signal, on the other hand, since it knows exactly where it still is concentrating its power in the WD. Okay. So, another option for spread spectrum is what's called direct sequence spread spectrum. And here, essentially, we achieve the spreading by increasing our bit rate. Okay. We encode our initial signal at a certain data rate using a higher bit rate coding sequence, okay, and so that means that these transmitted
higher your bit rate, the more spectrum you cover. Okay. So again, we can think we generate some sort of sequence with which we encode our original signal, and that encoding, if we can think of it as ORing the original bit with the signal, and so having done that, we transmit our signal, and we can recover our original signal by, again, knowing what our coding sequence is and applying that coding sequence again. So, again, we're using this with a phase shift, and so, again, we can think of, a plus or a minus amplitude. We apply our chipping sequence, and we can do that. We can do the two operations in either order. We can encode and apply the chipping sequence, or apply the chipping sequence, then encode. Okay. And at the other end, if we reapply the chipping the same chipping sequence, we recover our signal. So, again, here we have our original bits, we encode them, we then apply our chipping sequence, and again, what we're doing is we're increasing the rate at which we're changing our symbol. So it works pretty much in the same resistance. The jamming is working pretty much in the same way that it did before. We start out with a carrier frequency, and the jammer is going to have to try and jam the signal around that carrier frequency. Okay. What is happening? By using the spreading code, is that your signal is now being spread out over a greater bandwidth. And again, that means that your jammer is going to have to similarly spread its power over a greater bandwidth. Okay, so as was pointed out, it is work, but it does improve the quality of your signal. The question you might ask is, okay, so we've spread the bandwidth of our signal, how are we going to, haven't we reduced the number of users that can coexist together within the system?
right? So you, you have a fixed bandwidth you can transmit over. Now, it used to be we'd have these little narrowband sub-channels. Now we've got big, wider bandwidth sub-channels. Okay. And so the answer is that we have to be clever about how we code our signals so that we can allow multiple users to transmit within the same bandwidth. And what we're looking for is ways that codes so that two users, by applying their codes, can distinguish their signal from somebody else's signal. So to look at an example, we have a number of users. And they're sending at some sort of data rate. And each one is going to have a chipping code, which is breaking that user's bits up into now K bits. Okay. So each user is now going to be sending at a rate of K times their original data. Okay. We can think of this chipping code as, you know, just for notational purposes as a vector SI, which, and then a bit obviously is plus or minus SI. Okay. So, again, to recover a bit, we just apply our code, our SI, twice. And in order to distinguish users, what we really like is if you apply a different code, you cancel out the signal. So that means if you have the two signals going together, you apply your code, you pick out your signal, you cancel out anybody else's signal. Okay. You don't necessarily need complete orthogonality, so you don't need this to be exactly zero, but you'd like it to be as close to zero as possible. So there can be some overlapping codes, but you want it to be as small as possible. Okay. So we have an example here. K is 6. So our original bits are being divided up into 6 subbits. And again, let me just send it. Code, then you're sending plus and minus of that code now. So, if we look, CA is orthogonal to CB, CC, so you get, if you try and apply these to each other, you get 1 minus 1 is 0, 1. Minus 1, 0, minus 1, 1, 0 again. So if A and B send a signal, then you should be able to exactly recreate those signals. B and C, not so much. So you have 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 2. So there is some overlap. So, again, we have users A, B, and C using these three codes.
And if we then start with just A, and we'll send ones and zeros by plus or minus of the code. And so when we reapply our code, each of these goes to 1 for 1, we get 6, so it goes to minus 1, and minus 6. So there's a clear distinction between the two bits. Okay. So, you know, the question becomes, well, what happens if you get some other number? Either then the transmission errors will get that flipped somewhere, or you might be getting somebody else's signal who's using a non-orthogonal code. So, if we look at what happens when the codes are orthogonal, then if you have two senders, you have A and B now, and you start having orthogonal codes. So, A sends a signal encoded by A's code, B sends a signal encoded by B's code. When A goes to receive the signal, it'll receive both of these guys. It'll receive both what A sent and what B sent. But when it applies the code, it recovers the signal. When it applies its own code to these signals, that cancels out, which is zero. Okay. And so these ideas work even if you've got non-orthogonal chipping codes, as long as there's not too huge an overlap. Okay. So we looked before. B and C, they overlap by 2. And so, again, B and C send, in this case, a 1 and 0. Again, that signal would be combined, and B and C individually want to try and recover their signals. When B applies its chipping code to the signal, it gets value 4. When C applies its chipping code to the signal, it gets a value of minus 4. So it's not the 6, but it's still greater than 0 in the case of B, so even when the original signal was 1, it's still less than 0 in the case of C. So it includes so it's sort of, it's adding noise. It's almost like adding noise to the signal. But if enough information gets through, if you can filter out enough of that noise, then you'll recover your original signal. Okay. So, what are the issues with CDMA? Well, there's several. One is, it's sensitive to delay effects, and this is just because, again, you're increasing your bit rate, so if you delay enough, you're getting essentially inter-symbol interference. Okay. And so typically you have more complicated receivers to try and counteract that effect, which try and have ways of estimating the delay of the receiving signal and applying then a shifted signal to try and recover the original signal. Okay. There's also issues with power control in CDMA. Again, what are we doing? We're letting lots of people send their signals at the same time. And what happened in that, what was sort of implicit in the example I showed you, was that they were all being received at the same level, the same power level. Okay. If they're not, then you're going to distort that signal. So the contribution of one sender is going to dwarf or interfere with the contribution of any other sender or another sender. Okay. So in order to use CDMA properly, you're going to have to do the power control. Okay. And so it's usually referred to as, if you think of having a base station, that's referred to as the near-far problem. If you're near the base station, high power, so your signal will arrive at higher power if everybody transmits at the same level. If your signal would arrive at a much higher level than somebody who's far from the base station. Okay. That's going to cause, again, interference for the signals and not being able properly. So, what's typically used is what's called channel inversion techniques, and essentially, if you're close to the, if you're far from the base station, you send at a higher power level, and if you're close, you send at a lower. So again, this can be, this is complicated. It requires some sort of cooperative signaling back and forth between the base station and the senders. And again, if you think of having neighbors, if you think of having more than one base station, then you can start off not only to, you might solve problems for yourself, but you're at the edge of your range, blasting a signal back to your base station. You're also blasting it into the next range. So you'll start interfering with other areas as well. Okay. Again, there are some technical issues to be dealt with. The final thing we'll consider in relation to this technique is choosing the spreading sequences. How do we choose an appropriate spreading sequence? And we want the spreading codes to be noise-like, which means that they have approximately the same number of zeros and ones. And we want no repeating patterns. Okay. We also want this idea of orthogonality. Okay. And so there's two common categories. There are PN sequences, and they satisfy first couple of criteria, so your number of zeros and ones is okay, and you get no repeating patterns, and they also won't interfere with time-shifted versions of themselves. But typically, if you want orthogonality, you sort of need to be
be a bit more explicit about building that into your codes. Okay. So we'll look at how PN sequences can be generated and then how orthogonal codes can be generated. Okay, so our first requirements are this idea of randomness, and okay, so we're going to go around the labor points of sort of what makes a random sequence, but we want roughly the same number of zeros and ones, and we also want them again to occur in what looks sort of random, like a random fashion. You don't want to have 100 ones followed by 100 zeros and keep going like that. So you want sort of different levels of sequences with more shorter sequences and less longer sequences. Okay. It's also desirable that, obviously, that, again, if we have time shifting, then shifted versions of the code be orthogonal to non-shifted versions. Okay, so one of the simplest way to generate this sort of type of code is what's called linear feedback shift registers. And they can be used to generate sequences that have all these nice characteristics. And only repeat after long periods. They're also, we're able to implement them using hardware, okay, so a combination of logic and shift registers. Okay. So essentially what this is representing is some sort of polynomial. And again, why this all works is polynomial theory. Okay. The properties it has is, again, if you're clever about how you choose it and you have n bit input, then you can get a sequence of 2 to the n. And you can always find some way of getting that maximum length. Okay. And as long as you don't do something stupid initializing your sequence, then you actually get a good sequence. Okay. Okay, so again, the theory behind it is sort of outside of the scope, but we will just look at an example here. And so, again, we have 4 bits, which we combine and then use a shift register to continue the sequence. So we'll start out at an initial, some sort of initial state. In this case, we picked B3 was 1, B2 was 1, and 0 was 0. And so then what we're going to do is
calculates V1 XOR to V0 to become V3, and everything else shifts. Okay. And then our output is V0. Okay. So, 0 XOR to 0, 0, so the 0 moves to V3, and V3 shifts to V2, V2 shifts to V1, V1 shifts to V0, and our output then is V0. We calculate V0 plus V1 again, that becomes V3, and everything shifts, and we keep doing that, we keep shifting.
So what we see is that, again, our n here, the n is 4, so we can get a sequence of, at most, 2 to the 4 of 16, and we see, well, 16 minus 1, we see that, again, when we get back to 16, then we're back at our initial conditions. And obviously, once you're back at your initial condition, everything just kicks off again. Okay, so that's roughly the idea of how that works. And again, they have all the nice properties that we're looking for. Including the idea that if you shift by a small amount, then you are becoming nearly orthogonal. Okay, so if you do have time delayed signals, then they're just going to they don't cause interference. Okay. And so there are, again, more complicated versions that have better properties, and in particular, ways of generating multiple sequences which are not going to be correlated with each other. Now, the easiest way to develop an orthogonal sequence is to just explicitly build it. And orthogonal sequences can be explicitly built using what's called Walsh codes. And the one drawback of a Walsh code over these PN sequences would be that they're predictable. So, if you're trying to use it for security purposes or encoding purposes, then it's not going to work. But they do explicitly give you your orthogonality. Okay. Walsh codes are generated recursively. And so you start and take form of a matrix. And so you start with this trivial matrix 0, and then your next matrix doubles both the number of columns and rows, and it's 3 copies of the matrix, and then the converse of the matrix. Yeah, so. Anything that's 0 becomes 1, anything that's 1 becomes 0. Okay. So, any row of this matrix is orthogonal to any other row of this matrix.
not have the property that is, if you, that's the code and shifted version is not orthogonal. Okay, so you don't have the property of resistance behind the leg. Okay, so you have to synchronize your systems and make sure that you're not experiencing inter-symbol interference. Okay, so again, we started with 0, and that went to 0.001. We then, the next matrix would be a 4x4 matrix, and we then take this matrix, reproduce it 3 times, and then reproduce the negation of it, so 1, 1, 0. Next time, you get an 8x8, so doubling the rows and columns, you take this matrix 3 times, and then the negation of that matrix. Now, one nice property of this is that you can use variable length orthogonal codes and they will still be orthogonal to each other. And this can allow users to run at different data rates. Okay. So, essentially, you're using your codes to expand the data rate to the same level for all users. Okay, so what's the very high level takeaway? Spread spectrum techniques do provide immunity from frequency selective fading effects. They're relatively simple to implement. We can use CDMA to share the spectrum amongst multiple users. In order to do that, we're going to need to encodings that are either orthogonal or near orthogonal. Okay. It's always going to be sensitive to multipath delay effects, and as we saw, there were sort of issues with power control. Okay. So these systems were used, they represented improvements on sort of basic modulation techniques. And so the 3G systems in particular use these sorts of techniques. And when we talk about and cellular systems, keep that in mind. It turns out that they essentially plateau out in terms of the performance that could be extracted from these sorts of systems. So the technique which is sort of now prevalent and is used in sort of most modern high-performance systems is what's called orthogonal frequency division multiplexing. And it can be used with MIMO, multiple input, multiple output. Okay. So this is used by modern wireless LAN standards, NEC, WiMAX, so broadband wireless, and also 4G cellular systems. So I'm going to take a break now, and when we return, we'll talk about what we get out of OFDM, and depending on time, MIMO. If I don't have time to finish it, I'll just take it up next lecture. Okay, so the usual about 15 minutes.